lights out, and away we go here at Spa. Hamilton gets away well, Perez as well. Valtteri Bottas has got his teammate right alongside him already. But we have a safety car now deployed.
Yeah, no, it's been a while. 6 months, probably, I'm thinking, since the last race. The last season ended early because of the World Cup, didn't it? In like November.
Yes.
This is the first time. Yeah, exactly. November 2022 has been a long time. We do exist. We've, what's it called? Risen from the dead, as it were, as this podcast. How are you, Naz? How are you? Thanks for joining. Thank you for joining us again. How's your 2023? It sounds, I don't know if that's even a weird thing, but I think when you speak to someone for the first time in a year, you should probably ask them, how's the year going? What's the frame of mind before we think about these problems that are caused by a bunch of guys who drive cars around in circles?
I mean, I think my 2023 is going all right. We were having a conversation earlier. I'm a candidate attorney, and I've recently passed my two last boards.
That's it. Yes, I'm proud of you. Well played.
With studying for board exams, and now the next thing is to look for admission, but that's next year's problem, so we won't worry about that. But apart from that, I think I've been good. My mood is not reflected by the Mercedes performance. So I will put that at the outset. I am feeling good. But it's not because the things at Brackley are good. It's just, you know, I have long since moved on from pinning my hopes and my mood to the particular weekends that come our way. So, you know, but so we're good, yes.
I think congratulations. I know that those board exams to become an admitted attorney is not easy in any way. So super, super proud of you. I know that you're going to be amazing what you do. I know you've done amazing things already. So super, super proud of you. And thanks for joining us. And I think, you know, let's, whatever, man. Like all the latitudes, whatever, we'll speak about at the end. If anyone's still listening at that point. Right. I mean, you said the mood is not the mood of a meeting. Mercedes Formula One AMG.
Ooh, don't forget the Petronas trial.
Pardon? The Petronas, of course. With a big INEOS sticker at the back there. If Manchester United fans might be interested in that. But I do want to sort of talk about the Monaco Grand Prix itself, because I think that represented a significant upgrade in performance, not just on the car. That's what I think. I don't know. But before Monaco and coming up to Monaco, we had Bahrain, which is a little bit of a nightmare. I think Australia, Saudi Arabia, I don't remember it being particularly bad, but I think that was, there were always suspicions that was track specific. Baku wasn't great. Miami wasn't great either. So what was your feeling going into Monaco about where the team is and perhaps more broadly where Formula One is right now? There's a lot that's happened. It's going to be very difficult to condense this into things, but we'll give it a good crack.
I mean, I think, so coming into Monaco, of course, I think your listeners will be aware that we were supposed to race in Emilia-Romagna. That didn't happen because they had flooding. Of course, that was the right decision. There was no need to put any more pressure on the hospital infrastructure specifically than there was already from the flooding. I think it was probably, although with that being said, I probably think bringing the upgrades to a track like Imola probably might have been a little bit better because you have more of a traditional circuit in the sense that it's a proper kind of circuit.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so you can kind of predict more or less what's happening and you're far better to extrapolate kind of what's happening with the car, which direction is the car going. So I think although Monaco was a good showing on the whole for Mercedes, and it does look like things are turning a corner, I do think we probably need to go to Barcelona to be able to make a judgment call on exactly what's happening with the car. Did they get it right? Did they fix it? Did they turn it around? Generally, on the whole, my feelings on the season, Max has been dominating. We were teased with the idea of a Red Bull fight for the championship. Soundly disabused of that view very quickly. Some might say 4 minutes into Q1. He didn't even give us until the end of Q1.
I mean, he threatened to do this. Like, there were the murmurs, and then he binned it in Q1 in Australia, right?
Yes.
After he won Saudi. And,
yes, I remember that.
I'm sorry. Please do keep your train of thought before I cut you. But I just remember he had a bad qualifying in Bahrain. Mm. But when you looked at the data and the race pace, he matched Max Verstappen toe for toe in Bahrain. But he just started further back. And then he went in Saudi. Max couldn't live with him, of course, when Max was coming from further down the field. So we were going to Australia thinking, oof, what, you know, check up and bins it in Q1. Bins it in Q1. Has to start at the back, but it, you know what? Let me not cut you off. There's so much to discuss. Yeah.
So we had the Max show. So that was, I mean, you know, the people who are aware of me will know that Max is not one of my favorites. He might sit right at the top of my list, I might say. So, you know, that's been interesting. But I do think, I will give Max's flowers for Monaco. I think that lap, that qualifying lap, probably won him the race. Obviously there were things that might have happened on the Sunday with the change of tires that Aston Martin didn't go for when they said they could have gone for but didn't.
Yeah.
All of that aside, I think he did really well. I was listening to some other podcasts and they were talking about how generally the trend was in the first two sectors that Aston Martin tended to do better, and it was really in the third sector where Red Bull had the most advantage. And I think even if that is true, which I don't think it's not, I think it does take a lot of nerve and a lot of kind of to be able to hook a lap up together, to know where your limits are, to know where your strengths are, and still be able to put a lap together. You know, so I mean, I'll give him his flowers for that, but you know, it will end there. But basically,
boy, all is fair in love and war.
James Allison needs to fix that car. I can't keep giving this man flowers like this. It feels foreign to the mouth.
There's so much to unpack from what you've said there, so much. But I just want to, on the consistent theme of development, obviously, Hamilton crashes his car in FP3, I believe, and the car gets airlifted, and everyone has been talking throughout these regulations that the magic happens on the floor of the car, the one part of the car where, unless you were really, really stupid or careless as a team, basically no one can see. You know, you're not going to find guys walking around with pieces of the floor in the garage. Like, it's not going to happen, because that's the importance of the secret of what happens underneath the car. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Mercedes have obviously gone on a development curve. We know that they brought a new floor this weekend. And then obviously we have loads of cameras and pictures, a cameraman taking pictures of the underfloor of the car, of the Mercedes. But, and this is something that I don't know if you picked this up, and I'd be interested in your comments. Obviously, Checo then bins his car in Q1 on Saturday. And the Red Bull was also lifted by the crane.
Hoisted into the air. She was hanging by a thread.
It was these cars. But I'm interested because I Toto said something that suggested to me a little bit of annoyance. The suggestion being that there were like tons of photos of the Mercedes floor, tons. Mm. Everywhere you looked, it was like Mercedes floor. But the Red Bull was also airlifted, but we don't seem to have as many readily available pictures. My question is about that. Like, how do you think that happens? Because I would think it's just normal cameramen. Or do you think, you know, Red Bull does have some sort of hold on, you know, the media? And are they calling in their friends and saying, don't post these pictures? How far would you take this from a constraint? I mean, there's enough. I think, personally, I think there's enough. There are enough photos of the Red Bull, but it doesn't, we've seen, let me put it that way, because I'm no longer on Twitter, but like, I've seen loads of pictures of the Mercedes. I might have seen one of the Red Bull.
Mm.
How does that happen?
I mean, I think part of it is a novelty thing. I think we're probably a little bit more familiar with the Red Bull in terms of what it looks like generally. And I think there's probably a lot more interest in the Mercedes because there's at least this perception that they're going in a direction that potentially could yield significant results. And so people are like, hang on, like this could be our moment. But I do think also, although a significant part of the performance comes from the floor of the car, you also have to make the bits work together. And there are bits that we are not privy to. And it's not exactly that if you do a like for like assemble that you'll have the entire car. You know what I mean? People have probably been trying to copy Adrian Newey for forever and a day. And yet we don't have a whole bunch of rocket ships, you know, akin to the Red Bull style and the Red Bull philosophy of making cars. So I think a lot of it might just be the novelty of it all, the idea that it's new, the idea that they could be onto something. And I think that perhaps it was not ideal for the car to be hoisted into the air. But I mean, it is what it is. You know, I think that's where we're at. And I think there's probably, I think that Toto needs to calm down just a tad. I also think it's kind of like they're playing a bit of like a game. They're almost playing like they're almost bluffing. So they're like, yeah, let's make all of this noise about how wonderful, you know, how secretive, because secretly we think, you know, it's really impressive and give the impression that we basically hold the keys to the kingdom. When maybe, I mean, you know, if you don't create as much consternation, people might be more inclined to kind of just look at it and move on.
That's interesting. I think that's, yeah, you'd be good in PR too. I think one thing that does strike me, again, just a side note on the development conversation is that I know that, you know, I'm speaking to a specific audience. A lot of the things that Red Bull say, people don't tend to want to believe. I'm going to say want to be, well, they don't believe it, but I think it comes from an inclination to not want to believe. And at the beginning of 22, before the cars had hit Bahrain, in an interview, Adrian Newey mentioned that he had actually not been that deeply involved in the aerodynamic side of the RB18 then, but rather that he had spent almost all his time looking at the suspension. Now, a lot of people called bluff and they said, yada, 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 yada. But I think we now know where we are at this phase of the cycle that it does actually appear that this is the suspension, particularly the rear suspension of the Red Bull where the magic is. And I think, you know, just for Adrian Newey and to give him his flowers, the ability to preempt where you make the difference. Is important. And like, I think it does speak a lot about why perhaps you have a guy like Dan Fallows, not Aston Martin, who I'm very excited to talk about. Obviously worked in the aerodynamics department with Red Bull. And for all of the improvement that they have made, there is an alternative train of thought, which is that, well, they're still quite a way behind. Right. So where are they going to find this magic? It's not entirely going to be aerodynamic. So I agree with you that maybe the teams are just sort of diverting attention. And don't get me twisted. Every team in the paddock has the photos that they want, right? Yes. Of the Red Bull yes. floor. As much as I or you or anyone else may not have seen in the public certain photos, every team has every single photo. Like that is not to be mistaken. But
I mean, it's not quite the McLaren photocopy scandal, but everybody has.
Oh, good old Spygate, eh? Oh, geez, the sport has had absolutely childish moments. Like, I mean, there was Spygate and there's Crashgate the next
day. Crashgate.
Do you think Formula One is rotten 2021? That 2007.
McLaren was in trouble.
2008 Ferrari hot era. And I remember there was another team. I think it was Renault in 2008, who, because I think McLaren got like $100 million was their fine, I think, for Spygate, if I remember correctly. And then Renault the next year had something that just was like a little bit more hush, guys. I'm going to have to just, you know, go back to, you know, deep into my memory bank. Had something that was slightly more hush. Pretty much nothing happened to them. I said FIA. But I would like to, before we get on to the race itself, something that I am very interested in, like the sort of more technical side of the sport as well. Last week, this is again pre-Monaco, Aston Martin signs a deal with Honda for 2026. And Honda is now a sole engine supplier to Aston Martin from 2026. That effectively makes them a works team because Honda's not going to be supplying engines to anyone else. Yes. They'll be working to homologate their engine with the Aston Martin chassis. Is that the final piece of the puzzle for Aston Martin? Because, of course, they've got the money. We're in a cost cap environment.
That is true.
And of course, we've seen the development that they've made from 2022 to 23. I think they were incredibly brave. I think you and I had this discussion sometime last year during 2022 around the Australia-Brazil time, where it was just like, sorry, I said Australia, I meant America, Circuit of the America-Brazil time races, where suddenly Aston Martin and Vettel, and particularly in the hands of Vettel, looked like a team transformed. I didn't anticipate that they would propel themselves to sort of best of the rest behind Red Bull. But so we've seen that the key staffing infrastructure changes that they made at the beginning of 2022, end of 21, whatever your timeline is with that, works. But they've also got Lance Stroll. So, like, where does... do you have any thoughts about Aston Martin Honda thing? And I think the more pointed question is, does Lance Stroll have a future in that team if it's going to become a team that's going to win a constructors title?
I think that Daddy Stroll needs to decide whether or not he wants to become a championship winning outfit or whether or not he would like for his son to continue to have a seat, because I think for me those two positions seem somewhat untenable. Not to say that Lance Stroll is a bad driver. He has a few podiums to his name. He had that really good pole lap in Turkey of 2020. Yeah. Where he just managed
to race the Hamilton
He managed to put the car together. He managed to put together a lap that was really good enough to get him pole. And I think he has a few podiums from before then. He's also had, I think, one or two podiums after that. So it's not that he's a bad driver, but I think what becomes glaringly obvious is if you're in pursuit of a championship, you need a different level kind of driver. And he doesn't have that kind of missing factor. He's not an Alonso. He's not a Max. He's not a Lewis Hamilton. He can get the job done. And so I think, like I said, I think Lawrence Stroll, I was about to say Lance, and then I got the right one. Lawrence Stroll needs to decide what it is that he wants to do with this team, because I think he actually just has to choose whether he wants his son to have a seat. Or perhaps he can do a deal with somebody else where he can go elsewhere and then get somebody else into that seat so that they can then be serious about this gig. You know, because I think, the problem is that Lance just doesn't have that it factor. He started off really well in the beginning of the year, even with his hand injuries, but he just seems to have a particular ceiling And once he hits that ceiling, it then kind of plateaus. Whereas I think even with somebody like Alonso, the ceiling is a lot higher. And even in his advanced age, he seems to be better at hitting that ceiling and staying kind of close to the top of that ceiling. Of course, he's now older. He's no longer a two-time. I mean, he was a two-time world champion, but that isn't the case now. That ceiling obviously has come down, but it's still relatively higher to Lance.
I like that idea about having maybe trying to see if he can find him a seat elsewhere on the table. On the table, jeez. On the grid. Jeez. Yeah, man, listen, it's been a long day.
So, I mean, he needs to I think Aston Martin and the pursuit of Lawrence Stroll to make it a top running team, I think by and large is close to fruition. I think perhaps Honda has shown that they're capable of putting together a decent engine. The only problem with Honda is that they are rather fickle.
Is there a more indecisive team or engine supplier in the history of Formula One? I don't understand them. I don't understand them at all. But anyway, that's a topic.
They are the epitome of umming and aahing when it comes to their involvement in Formula One. So I think it's a good move. I think it's impressive. It allows, and I think, like you said, Lawrence has the resources for them to be able to really commit to being a top flight team. So I think we'll have to see what the future holds. Like my proposal is that Daddy Stroll needs to find Lance a seat elsewhere, and he needs to get somebody who will be serious in that seat. Because I think it's also not helpful for them, because Alonso is getting older. You need to have some kind of succession. Felipe Drugovic, I think, is their reserve driver. He doesn't have any Formula One experience, and so it's then going to be very awkward if he disappears, if Alonso retires, Felipe must come in, but Lance is still there, and then now you're kind of like, okay, well, what does the succession plan look like? So they need to think long and hard about what the next step is.
I think you've raised so many really, really good points. Once you said it, we need to find him another seat. I could totally imagine him at Williams, right, in the seat alongside Alex Albon. But enough about Lance Stroll. I think I'm in agreement with you. I think his ceiling, he's got some very high highs, but he just doesn't get there consistently. And I think his problem is actually his lows are very low. I mean, to be driving, like you were mentioning in Bahrain, where, I'm not a doctor, but I certainly don't think he should have been driving. Had he broken his wrist? It was something extreme, right? And he still took the car. I think his problem is now that Mercedes in particular look like they're catching up. And now suddenly all you have is one stinking weekend like he did at Monaco. And Mercedes are 1 point behind in the Constructors' Championship, despite Alonso being on the podium, I think, at every single race this season, bar one. What happened in Jeddah? Did he get the penalty in the end?
Yes, he got the podium back, didn't he?
Anyway, it's neither here nor there details. But the point is, Alonso is able to deliver at such a consistent level. Mm-hmm. And you just can't have that sort of disparity between two drivers. He's always given me the sense that he's disinterested. And I don't know if that's fair to compete at that level. But it's just something I can't shrug. And maybe if you're going to have an interested team, a team that wants to be serious, you can't have a driver like that. But I find Aston Martin really fascinating. Fernando Alonso, does he stick around up until 2026? I mean, they've got the option to extend his contract to 2025. I've read a few articles by some former race engineers and stuff who basically don't really believe the hype that you slow down significantly with age. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we slandered, or certainly I slandered, Laurent Rossi and Alpine for the way that they handled Alonso last year. I think if they had themselves together, he would still be racing at Alpine, although he'd be significantly more upset. More on Esti Besti in a moment. But it's a question that no one can answer, but everyone has to ask. How long can Alonso keep doing this for? Because he is 41. Like, surely at some stage, something's got to give, right? Like,
I mean, sure. I think he can continue until he no longer feels up to it. The one thing I will give Alonso is he still seems incredibly passionate about being in a car and being in a fast car. Because I think there was a point last year where Vettel, and I think probably in the twilight era really of Vettel's career, where it kind of felt like he was there, but he wasn't doing much, right? So he wasn't fighting, you know, and perhaps we could also discuss maybe he didn't have the tools to fight. But I think there seems to be a certain hunger from Alonso that I think as long as he can maintain that he probably can continue for a while. I mean, I think we're in the era where we have people like Tom Brady at like 45. I don't want to age him too much. I don't know how old that man is. But, you know, people who are...
He's a footballer, right?
Yes, he's the American footballer, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where the idea that you taper off in your mid-30s, and at your mid-30s towards your late-30s, you're nearing kind of veteran era, veteran stage. I think that's been changed in recent years where that's no longer the case, where you still have people playing competitively or taking part in competitive sport at a very high level at an advanced age. So I think also driving cars might be different, for example, to kind of a tennis or a American football. That's far more physical on the body, and you have a lot more kind of your actual joints are the things that are the problems. And of course, as you age, that gets older, whereas there are certain kind of, yes, you have G-force effects when you're driving cars, but there's a way to kind of counteract and manage that and make sure that you're not perhaps overstretching yourself. So I think his advantage, Alonso's main advantage, is his drive and the fact that he can manage what his career can manage manage the stresses that he would be put under as a Formula One driver. Yes.
Yeah, I just also think Alonso, I know this is going to sound ridiculous, but please bear with me, guys. Alonso has never, besides maybe that 2005 championship winning season, he's never really struck me as blindingly fast in the way that Leclerc and Verstappen do, right? And of course, certainly a younger Lewis Hamilton. I think Lewis Hamilton, as he's gotten older, exhibits more of this, where you don't always think to yourself, geez, like, of, you know, like, that was just, he just blindingly got pure raw pace. What he's able to do is he's able to drive the lap perfectly. And perhaps, you know, that was the difference for Alonso this weekend over one lap versus the race pace, where he was probably, inhibited by the Aston Martin in the race. But on one lap, you know, Max had that something intangible that you can find in spellbinding pace, and perhaps that actually aids his longevity, whereas he's not relied on raw speed. Perhaps almost actually a better example, Kimi Raikkonen, where Kimi Raikkonen in the early 2000s, I still maintain, is just one of the fastest drivers that I've ever seen. But, you know, I could ramble on with that for a long time, because I am interested to speak about the other veteran on the grid, Sir Lewis Hamilton. And I say that I'm interested to speak about him because finished P4, he had the crash in FP3. He didn't look all the way happy throughout the weekend, and then after the race said that's the happiest he's felt in the car for a very long time. What do you make of his headspace I think the Ferrari stuff, most people, those rumors, most people would bat away. I've not really read whether anyone has outright refuted them, but I don't think it would take them really seriously. Interesting weekend, but I'm, again, just his frame of mind and just to frame where we are in the season, really after Monaco, a lot happier than I've seen him with this car, probably since the beginning of the ground effect era.
I think the thing with Hamilton that I think we've seen is he feels everything, right? So
yes.
I think part of the problem with the previous car is he just wasn't feeling it and he wasn't very confident in the car. And I think the fact that he feels off the bat happy is a good indication that there's something about the car that seems to resonate back to him, which I think it is a good sign of where he is at. I think also they've had a bad car for such a long time. I mean, like, I'm trying to polish a turd here, but part of the problem why he hasn't felt comfortable in the car is because the car has been ass.
I'm sorry. Oh man, this gives me so much joy. Yes.
So the fact that they've turned the corner, my goodness. I'm happy to let him go forth and conquer. Like I said, I think somebody said that the next few tracks, I think up to and including probably even Hungary, are tracks that he's quite comfortable with, tracks that he's traditionally done quite well. So I think it's a very good sign that the car has changed. He seems to at least be happy with the changes in the car, and we're moving towards tracks that he's historically absolutely dominated. And of course, we're not going to have that dominance repeated. But just for all of those to be lining up, I think is a good indication of where he's at. As a Mercedes fan, as a Lewis Hamilton fan, we have toiled, my God. We have toiled.
I think what you're saying about the upcoming circuit is actually really interesting because, and please, again, everything that I say must be understood in its context, right? When you are someone like Hamilton, you know, with 100 plus race wins, it can sound off the bat ridiculous to say that he has any particular weaknesses, but these are comparative weaknesses. And Monaco has been a track where he can really blow out. He can, I remember, was it 2017? He started 14th.
Mm.
Oof. 2021 starts 7th. That was the first moment where the pendulum swung in momentum in that particular championship fight. And last year, Hamilton, Monaco, not a great weekend. I think he was also P7. So he has instances where he struggles with sort of rear limited tracks. And I'll chat about that in another pod when we've got a little bit more time. So I think the point that you're making, that if he's happy with the feeling of a car at a place like Monaco, where it hasn't always been his personal best track, then that gives a lot of positivity. And I think, you know, he's obviously complained about how far forward he is in the cockpit of this car. That's not something that can be changed this year. But I think for Mercedes, you know, to sort of calibrate things, especially after Barcelona, get his feedback on, like you said, just how he feels in the car is super important. But I would be interested, perhaps a bit of a segue. What do you think he feels of his teammate who has a proclivity right now?
Proclivity right is now, a very strong word.
It's
a very appropriate word.
And you know what? Let me get my bit out of this, and I'd love to hear your interest. I personally don't care what drivers really say in the thing. No, I don't. I've had a strong belief. I don't know. Do you recall Miami and the fiasco over The decision to pit him or not pit him, and then he gets caught out by the safety car. And they were constantly asking him, I'm talking about Hamilton now, sorry if I didn't make that clear, Miami last year. And there was just a huge issue of miscommunication between Hamilton and his pit wall, right? And my thesis was always just that Mercedes have actually leaned too heavily on Hamilton, right? Rather than making decisions. The polar opposite of that spectrum is Max Verstappen, who sort of just tells GP, my front lift's going. He doesn't say, I have to come in now. Of course, I'm sure I could find random examples where he does do that. But he's sort of accedes to the team's requests. And I always felt that George Russell recognized that, but he recognized an opportunity to try and take control of a pit wall that's indecisive. That's where I think it's coming from. And so for me personally, I don't really mind him doing that because I actually think the pit wall must be strong enough to just simply say no. I don't mind if a driver says swap us, personally. I don't care. It's up to the pit wall in my mind to tell him
to
no,
make that decision.
But he does, he's starting to get a little bit whiny, isn't he? He's talking about annoying. He could catch Ocon. Brother,
it was very wild because I would have given him something if he hadn't forgotten that he was driving in the wet.
He had the ultimate strategy. He had the perfect strategy. He comes out ahead of Ocon.
He decides
to drive straight into Sandoval. Yeah, unbelievable.
So you know, but I think for me at least, my feelings around George Russell, I think have to do a lot with how he's been perceived in the media, his recognition of that perception, and I think an attempt to almost play that perception up. I think that he's very aware of the position that he's in, being kind of the young upstart to a veteran Lewis Hamilton who's on his way out. What I think is particularly concerning, though, is he seems to be happy to kind of, and even if we say that he uses his radio messages more as a signal to the rest of the paddock or to the rest of the world, as opposed to him trying to get something done with those messages, I do think it's concerning that he seems to be happy to take the position that he's in some way outdoing Lewis Hamilton. I think for me, that's the thing that I struggle with, is there's already this perception throughout last year. And I mean, we'll give him his flowers for having finished the season ahead of Lewis Hamilton. But I think when you take that approach, it then doesn't take into account the incredibly nuanced season that they had, where they had a very bad car, where because of the experience that Lewis Hamilton had, it was better for him to be kind of the guinea pig. It was better for him to take on the more risky setup strategies because they knew he could kind of handle it, or they knew that if things were to come right, that he would be the beneficiary of that. And so we then get a result. And I think in the second half of the year, he kind of smoked him. You know, I mean,
absolutely. The second half of the season, Hamilton has been a thing for nearly two decades now.
I mean, right?
I've never seen anything like it. There will be theses written about what Hamilton does in the second half of a Formula One season. But anyway, I cut you off. Sorry.
So I think with all of that being said, I think that George is aware that he has the ability to kind of shape the narrative. And I think, especially where there is a need to label Hamilton as being over the hill, where there's a need to label Hamilton as being kind of on his way out, the senior statesman, and here comes this young upstart who's about to change the show. I think he finds that attractive and he finds it alluring. And I think for me personally, that's a problem because I'm a Lewis Hamilton fan. But I also don't think it serves him because I think that there is a way for him to still be about himself and wanting to make sure that as a driver that he achieves the things that he wants without seeming whiny and like a dickhead the whole time. Honestly,
it can't be
that there's only one way for you to seem like you're trying to stake your own identity within the Mercedes team. Like, come on.
And I think, let me be clear. I think on raw talent, he's better than the two drivers I'm about to list. But what he's doing now, it's starting to me. I know I singularly said I don't normally mind drivers, you know, testing the limits. Let's do team limits and stuff. But I'm reminded of how he was asked to move aside for Hamilton and Jeddah and was basically just like, no, catch me. And then he drove off in a, almost what I found to be a thinly veiled act of defiance, you know, because of his persona.
Something about Alonso, was it Alonso who needed to serve a time penalty? And it was like, bro.
Yeah, and he was like, brother.
Step aside. Step aside. But yet he's very comfortable to go in Australia and say, well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do if my teammate is coming up behind me and I'm trying to chase the guy in front of me. And it's like, no, but he's also trying to get away from the person behind him. So you're in the same boat. It's not just he has it out for you. Like, let's please, you know. So anyway, you were saying, sorry, I cut you off.
I think that's actually very important. He's starting to remind me of Jenson Button and Nico Rosberg, who for me had an unhealthy obsession with Hamilton and almost forgot everything else. Mm. In fact, I would say they forgot everything else. I think if they were honest and honest interviews, Rosberg in particular, and Button at McLaren all the time. It's what is Hamilton doing? Whatever, you know, team orders, let me get aside, let me get in front, I'm faster. Whether these things were... there was even a hint of truth to them in any one particular moment, which was almost never. I think that really finished them mentally. And George Russell, I guess the dynamic is different because he's so much younger than Hamilton and he will have the chance to cultivate his own image. But, you know, just like we spoke about Alonso, and Hamilton just looks phenomenal. He just looks in incredible shape. Like, I mean, his skin's glowing. He's having a great time.
Girl, it's the Instagram baddies.
Dude, yeah. He's left the meat. But
he's in Antarctica. He's having the time of his life.
No, man, he's living a good life. I think living a balanced life is important. But if Russell doesn't watch out, he's going to tarnish his own image, and he's going to lose the valuable opportunity that he has to learn from Hamilton. And I'm talking about on track in the big moments. Like, bro, you don't have to beat him now. The singular target right now is Red Bull. And that's why I think Hamilton himself was quite unbothered last year. It never, as much as the media and some sections of social media and commentary were talking so much about how Russell beat Hamilton, it never struck me at any point in time that he cared, that Hamilton cared. It was like, well, we're not going to win the world championship. We need to get this car. And if Mercedes were to build a car that can fight for constructors' titles again, if he finds himself in a situation where Mercedes is a dominant car again and he only has to beat Hamilton, like you said, be very concerned by what you saw at the end of last year. Because if Verstappen saw it, Valtteri Bottas saw it several times where he would win, say, three of the first five races, and everyone would be like, oh my gosh, we've got a different title challenge here. And then he grinds you into the ground. Sebastian Vettel in 2018 spun at Germany. Hamilton took the lead of the championship in that race. He never relinquished it for another 3 years. Don't do this nonsense.
Yeah, I think you're so right about him missing out on a learning opportunity. Even if he does get beaten, it is not indicative of the type of talent that George is. George is undoubtedly the future star at Mercedes. I suppose for him, it might be a bit of an ego boost to be like, well, I've got, you know, the Sir Lewis Hamilton, you know, wrapped up under my knuckles. But I think he benefits far more by playing the team game than trying to almost show up Lewis Hamilton and show that he's incredibly special. You know, so.
Exactly. I mean, even just one win that he got in Brazil, you know, if Hamilton doesn't have that collision with Verstappen and lap one, I think, was it lap one? Anyway, in Brazil last year, Hamilton wins that race. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to take anything away from him, but I think the guy who came out of that car at Williams, and even the first half of last year, the guy who took a Mercedes when Hamilton had COVID in 2020 and would have won that race and in Sakhir had it not been for an all mother of mess ups by the, you know, that's the guy. And I don't feel like I've seen that guy. He seems, I don't know if he seems unsettled or unnerved. I'm not a psychologist. I don't know him, never had a beer with him, but he needs to get it together. Like he needs to get it together very, very quickly, or else, you know, things would thingy. But Naz, we don't have a lot of time left. I do want to have a great shout out, and I think we'll have more conversations in the weeks to come. But so I'm not going to talk about Alpine in its entirety. We haven't even managed to speak about Ferrari, which is hilarious. But maybe we'll do that. Yes. These guys, we have not forgotten about Ferrari at any, you know, that again, that probably needs its own special. But shout out Esty Bestie, right?
doing the Lord's work. All of us are residents of one Esteban Ocon Island. When he put it on provisional poll, I sat up.
I was freaking out.
I said, I'm sad. Oh,
goodness. This is, he, you know, one thing I have to say about Monaco, I think there have been some slight criticisms from certain corners. This idea that, you know, he sort of knew he was at Monaco. Once he bagged his P3, you know, just sort of defended. And then, you know, the delta that Alonso and Verstappen pulled, you know, they dropped the whole field. Is an argument that I would perhaps accept if Esty Bestie hadn't been notorious for these types of drives where he's absolutely flawless before his win at Hungary. He did exactly the same thing where he was absolutely flawless when everyone around him was freaking out.
Also in Japan last year at Suzuka against Hamilton.
Exactly.
That was also in the wet, right?
He has an uncanny knack of not making mistakes under pressure. And I think that's a fantastic sign from a driver. Because again, you know, maybe I'm picking on him a little bit, but George Russell was on the right strategy, ran the hards, came out P3 and then binned this car. You know, didn't bin it. Threw it into the runoff. Whatever that thing is called. Sorry, I've lost my words tonight. And Esteban Ocon was able to hold it together and take home a fully deserved, I mean, and you know, to be driving, to be under pressure from Hamilton in the wet. Is something now. He's done that twice now. Shout out to him, because you know, of course, my favorite owner, Laurent Rossi, is not my favorite owner. I think he's one of the worst. Anyway,
I mean, I know we give Horner a lot of flack for being absolutely awful, but Laurent Rossi is also he's just so cringe.
The whole team on blast. He just puts the whole team on blast. But like I don't like people who don't take accountability. They really, really piss me off. Yeah. And you know, and he was talking about how Otmar Safnau is one of the best appointments that he's made. barely, not far towards the end of last season, and suddenly now everyone's dropped the ball and they need to get it together. I'm very annoyed that he might be very self-congratulatory right now, as if what he said would have had any effect. No, brother. Toto Wolff spoke about the upgrades coming onto the Mercedes for Monaco as far back as Bahrain. These things have development curves, right? Like, they didn't Alpine suddenly wake up 10 days ago when their owner's putting them on blast and suddenly decide, wait, let's wake up, let's make the car go faster. It doesn't work like that. That's not how
I mean, I do think on the whole, Alpine have been good, but I think they just needed to clean their act up a little bit. They were actually very good in Australia until they came together. That was a disaster.
That was an absolute disaster.
I mean, if there was ever a moment for him to completely chew them out, it should have been then, but obviously not publicly, between them in the motorhome. Not before, twice, actually, not even just once. He did it first with Canal Plus, and then he did it, I think he did a long form with Sky, and again, or Formula One, I beg your pardon, and then decided that he was going to do round. Like, if there was ever a lack of, like, self-awareness, it's displayed in one Laurent Rossi. So, I mean, he needs to go away.
He needs to.
Something needs to happen.
And leave Esti Bestie to do his thing. I think there would be the seeds of Gasly was okay, but we know, I mean, like you said, we saw it in Australia. They don't like each other. Gasly is not going to be very happy because he always does well at Monaco. And he did well, I suppose, this weekend, finishing P7. So it's not a bad performance. But when your teammate's on the podium, you want to try and Ocon, again, just, you know, comparing it to the Alonso and sort of Leclerc Verstappen comparison that I made earlier, I've always felt that Gasly, between the two of them, had that piece of magic. Like, if you had asked me, if you had told me that there is going to be an Alpine that pulls out a piece of magic on one lap, I would have bet that it was going to be Gasly, right? As opposed to Ocon. So, yeah, I think, I'm sure Gasly's going to look at that and think, okay, well, the challenge is on. The problem is, weekends like this, when the difference between P3 and P7 can make such a big difference in the overall driver's championship, because that's a huge points differential. So I am rambling a little bit. Shout out to him. Probably the driver of the day. I think Max won the race in qualifying with a stupendous qualifying lap, and fair play to him. He's obviously got a penchant around the street tracks, unlike one Sergio Perez, you know, because I'm thinking of the lap that nearly was at Jeddah. I mean, there's not a million degrees of difference between what Max was trying at Jeddah in 21 and what he did, because he clipped the walls a few times, if people haven't.
Yes, I mean, he was actually using the walls almost as like a bounce back. So he actually used the walls to
too. Like, yes, that takes an unreal amount of commitment. And confidence. I suppose perhaps he knew that if he didn't take pole, that he wouldn't win the race, and maybe he thought with Checo being out, or actually, it's going to be interesting, because he might have thought, well, Checo is out, I don't have to risk it. Even if I don't win this race, let me secure my P3. I'm still going to annihilate him points wise on a weekend.
I think Max is very much an all or nothing kind of guy. I think he has
every single race.
To temper it a little bit, I think bar Abu Dhabi 2021, that kind of all or nothing approach would have been the thing that would have cost him the championship, because there are certain instances where, you know, I think I'm trying to think of a race where
Australia this year where he let both Mercedes through.
Yes, because he knew that he would just catch them.
This year. Yeah.
So I think as much as he has, I think maturity and having more experience, specifically fighting for championship experience, has kind of shown him that you don't have to do all or nothing every single time that you race. That there's sometimes room to kind of let go because you know that you have the car to come back. So I think, yeah, I think he probably wasn't thinking about the fact that that Checo binned it very early in Q1 and still thought, I have to win. And I think he probably thinks in his mind that he can win every single race at every single point.
I think he genuinely believes that. And, you know, I talk about, oh, no, take it easy, take your P3, go home. And there's obviously merit to that. But, you know, I also am a guy sitting at his coffee table in South Africa, you know, like grinding, being ground down by the whims of capitalism.
By the man.
And he's and he's out there racing cars. And maybe I often have to admit to myself that there may be certain mental aspects to these guys, not just Verstappen, but all of these guys on the circuit that maybe I just can't tap into. And, you know, like I said, yeah, I would have been just like, you know what, take the points home, annihilate Perez. Whereas he's just like, nope, this is what we have to do to win, and we'll carry on doing it. But, you know, speaking of that, Naz, on a winning note, thank you for joining. This was such a fun discussion. We're nowhere near everything that we would have liked to discuss. I'm sure there are Ferrari fans. In fact, Ferrari fans might actually be grateful. There's a podcast out there for a whole hour that doesn't mention. Listen, guys, no, trust me, your time is coming. You know, we barely spoke about teams that improved, like McLaren, and Alfa Romeo this weekend, but we will get to that. We are back. We do have a regular schedule. Wame is around, but we'll be joined by Naz and a few more people throughout the rest of the year. So if you're still here, thank you for listening to us. Naz, thank you. Congratulations. So proud of you. Love chatting thank with you. And I hope that you will, in particular, join us very, very soon for another such discussion. I know we've got Barcelona this weekend. Going to be a lot of fun, and
I actually can't wait for Barcelona. That's the one that I'm very excited for.
Yeah, no, I've been looking forward to Barcelona. I've been looking forward to getting back to quote unquote. Look at me sounding like I'm 50 years old. Yeah, proper racing circuits. Melbourne, not a fan. Saudi. You know what? I have to give Saudi.
I like the fast-pacedness of Saudi.
It's not as bad as it was in 21. I think the ground fix have helped with that. Baku was obviously dreadful. Miami. Yeah. But, you know, your Silverstones and Barcelona's now, we're back to proper racing track. So I'm looking forward to it. And again, thank you. You're an absolute gem. Really enjoyed chatting to you.
Perfect. Thank you for having me.
Okay. All right. We'll see you soon. We'll chat soon. And oh, yeah. Shout out Esty Bestie one last time. Well played, young man.
Call us Esteban. My DMs are open.
Yeah, the Esteban Ocon Appreciation Corner, because I've had to abandon the Kevin Magnussen one because wow. But anyway. That's a topic for next time. All right.